Let's check that sound.
How are we doing on sound? That good?
Yeah.
All right, thank you. And Mark, three minis is enough. You don't have to give more than the many, 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 many years. So it has been quite a few, however. So it's in my 20s when I started this class. So, but it's good to be with you here all. I'm going to distribute these handouts in case you don't have them. We're looking at the book of Isaiah, and these are the study questions. And if you didn't get the scripture passages in Isaiah, because we did a study going through the book of Isaiah and what it has to say about the Trinity, got all the passages collected here. If you did not get that, then we'll take one with you. And we're also going to put it up on the paradoxes.org website. So you'll be able to see those passages there. And yeah, we've been talking about some of the changes here in the church. We are going to get new lights here, and that's going to really help the people that live stream with us, because once we've moved into this room, the resolution went way down just because we don't have good lighting here. So that will be fixed. So you can tell your friends that live stream with us. And you know, we're literally getting people live streaming throughout Europe and Asia, as well as here in North America. Now, before we jump into our study of Isaiah, I've been getting questions in my social media and also from some of you about this paper. This is the preprint, but it has been accepted for publication in Astronomy and Astrophysics. That's a European astrophysical journal. And it got a lot of you know, sensationalism on the web, because what they found orbiting a star, in fact, they call it Tea Garden Star, and that's the astronomer that discovered it, and it's one of the closest stars to our sun. It's just 12 light years away, and they've now discovered two planets orbiting this star, and the planets are just about 10 to 15% bigger than the Earth. So the big news is two Earth-sized planets orbiting this nearby star, and they're orbiting in what they call the habitable zone. But I've read the paper, they're orbiting the liquid water habitable zone, and the star they're orbiting is a very faint star. So we're talking about a revolutionary period of 4 and 12 days, respectively. So they're orbiting very close to that star, close enough that they must be tidally locked. And we know that for certain because the star measures to be about 8 billion years old. So it's quite a bit older than the solar system. And planets that close to the star orbiting for that long will be tidally locked. Matter of fact, a time will come when the Earth will be tidally locked. But that won't happen for another 36 billion years. So I wouldn't adjust your investment portfolio to take that into account. So. And if you're not familiar with the term tidally locked, think of the moon. The moon is so close to the Earth that the gravity of the Earth pulls more strongly on the near side and the far side, and the difference between the two gravitational pulls is sufficient that it forces one side of the moon to always face the Earth. That's what's called tidal locking. Or to put it another way, it's when the rotation period is roughly the same as the revolutionary period. Now, in the case of the moon, it's almost perfectly tidally locked, which means the rotation period is identical to the revolutionary period, so you only see one side of the moon. However, because the sun is also pulling on the moon, not just the Earth, and to a lesser degree Jupiter, but it's predominantly the sun and the Earth, it wiggles a little bit. So if you actually observe the moon night after night after night, you see 59% of the surface of the moon, just because it jiggles a little bit. But yeah, it is tidally locked. And Mercury and Venus are partially tidally locked, which means its rotation period is very long, just like the revolutionary period, but they're not identical. But these two planets that are in this paper here, they are tidally locked. Moreover, I was amusing because they're saying these are nearby habitable planets. If we mess up our planet Earth, we got a place to go. Well, not really. For many reasons, these are not habitable planets. If they're tidally locked, they're not habitable. But the irony was, in the same month, another paper was published, this time in the Astrophysical Journal, basically making the point, stars that are dimmer than the sun, planets orbiting them, are going to have a problem with carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide. Now, I've got a blog coming out on this. It's not yet released, but the blog is written, and I'm going to kind of take you through this. And basically, they've now discovered two more habitable zones. Now, when NASA talks about the habitable zone, they're only talking about the liquid water habitable zone. But now we've got 12 other known habitable zones. And for a planet to be truly habitable, it must simultaneously reside in all 13 habitable zones. Okay, of the 4,000 plus planets we've now discovered, only one of those planets resides in even three of those 13 habitable zones. And I'll give you three guesses which one that is. Okay? All right. And right. The one that we're sitting on right now. It resides in all 13 habitable zones, but no other planet even resides in three. However, just now they've added habitable zone 12 and 13 to the list. Now, several months ago, I wrote a blog talking about the 11 known habitable zones. That's going to have to be revised. Now we've got 13. And you say, why are you spending time on this? This adds to the fine-tuning argument for the existence of the God of the Bible. And basically makes the point that you see in Psalms and Job, the more we learn about nature, the more evidence we find for the supernatural handiwork of God. And so just in the past few weeks, papers have been published which illustrate that point in Job and Proverbs, that the more we learn about the realm of nature, the more evidence we see for the supernatural handiwork of God in designing the universe, our galaxy, and our solar system, and Earth in particular, so that advanced life can exist here. And what these authors have been printing in the Astrophysical Journal is that in terms of habitability, we've been overlooking the carbon dioxide problem and the carbon monoxide problem. And they say we've been overlooking it because when we think about life, we're only thinking about a few bacteria running around on a planet for a few months and then dying off. That's not really a habitable planet if you've got bacteria that can only exist there for a short period of time. For one thing, it takes much longer than that for any conceivable origin of those microbes. And so what this paper in the Astrophysical Journal is saying, if we're looking at habitability for life forms that have a circulatory system, which would include all animals, and actually plants, advanced plants have a circulatory system as well. And so these advanced plants and advanced animals, they have much more restrictive requirements for both carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide. And here are the limits they point out in their paper. And you say, what's that unit bar? That refers to how much air is in the atmosphere of a planet. And usually we talk about parts per million, but this is a term that physicists like because it actually talks about the total quantity of air in there. And very roughly, while one bar equals the atmosphere of the Earth, it's about 98.7% is the atmosphere of the Earth. And it's making the point that the carbon dioxide level drops down to 0.00018 bar, photosynthesis ceases. Now, to put that in terms of parts per million, that's 150 parts per million. So the atmosphere, the carbon dioxide in our atmosphere to drop to less than 150 parts per million in our atmosphere, photosynthesis ceases everywhere. Now, 150 parts, that's for sea level. Okay, if you happen to live at 3,000 feet, now we're talking 165 parts in order to get photosynthesis to be sustained. Because after all, as you go to higher and higher elevations, there's less and less air. So that 150 parts is for life at sea level. But as you go up in elevation, then you need a higher limit. But the thing they really focused on is how much carbon dioxide can circulatory animals and plants with circulatory systems experience before they begin to die. And it's basically saying, well, if it hits 0.00095, then that basically kills life in the oceans and the lakes. And makes the point, in order for human civilization to be sustained, we need life to exist in the oceans. Because if life doesn't exist in the oceans, number one, it can't produce the oxygen we need to breathe. And number two, that means we get no food supply from the oceans. And basically what happens is the oceans become too acidic. The carbon dioxide reacts with the water, makes a dilute acid, and that causes a problem. Those of you that are older can probably remember back in the 70s when it'd be raining here in Los Angeles and you get stinging eyes. Well, that was because the rain coming down was acidic, and that would happen in the oceans. You would get this acid that would sting the life there, and basically makes the point that if it were to hit 790 parts per million, then you get death in the oceans. And that's one reason why there's some concern about us pumping carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. I mean, before the Industrial Revolution, it was at 275 parts per million. It's now at 410 parts per million. And the concern is if it rises above 550, the oceans and the lakes are going to begin to be acidic. Not enough that everything dies there, but we are going to start seeing problems even at a level of, say, 550 parts per million. But then the paper goes on to say, well, okay, supposing you somehow can survive without life in the oceans, what about animals? At what point do they begin to suffer? And this is all based on hospital records. People actually come into emergency rooms. Got a question?
Yeah, Hugh, we had an online question from RJ. Is the spike in methane to 21 parts per billion found by Curiosity reported yesterday consistent with the water rock gas reactions Hugh mentioned last year? Is it possible for a chance of life?
Yeah, I think that's a reference to a paper that was published announcing that they found a spike of methane on Mars. The Martian rover has been looking for methane for the last couple of years, and they did find some, but this is a spike about three times higher than what they found about a year ago. And there's some excitement saying, well, if it's three times higher, maybe it comes from microbes that emit methane. Maybe we've discovered life on Mars. But I remember, and I wrote a blog on this about a year and a half ago, making a point, there's many ways you can get methane being produced on Mars without life. In fact, you can get quite a bit of methane produced without life. But basically what NASA is telling us, we've seen this spike, we need to follow it up. If it's a natural process, why would we get a spike? Well, you can get a spike if somehow it's trapped and then released. But the other interesting thing is the Europeans have a satellite orbiting Mars trying to sniff out methane, and they've not been able to find any. And it's actually more sensitive than the Martian rover that's on the land. Bottom line is, it's too soon to really tell what's happening with the methane on Mars. We do know you're going to get some methane without life. The question is this so much methane that it warrants digging down a little deeper? And if we start to see a whole lot of spikes, but it's just one spike. So right now I'd say too soon to tell, and I think there's strong evidence that it's not life-based. It's coming from abiotic processes. And we've got many reasons to believe that life cannot exist on Mars. However, one caveat, life gets transported to Mars all the time through meteoritic impacts, and that life can survive for a couple of seconds on Mars. Not long, it will die quite quickly, so we should find the remains of life on Mars. We know it's got to be there. However, the conditions, the chemical conditions on Mars are such it's not going to survive long. Moreover, Mars experiences deadly ultraviolet radiation. It doesn't have an ozone shield, and so the ultraviolet radiation from the sun, just like when they put you in a hospital, because kind of what they're doing now to keep you germ-free when you get surgery, they have you close your eyes, they put a thing over you, and they bathe you in ultraviolet radiation because they know that's going to kill any microbes that are around there. Question here.
Yes, I recently read an article called The Greening...
Wait for the microphone.
Thank you. I recently read an article called The Greening of the Earth, that the increase in carbon dioxide was resulting in the green belt around the Earth becoming much, much greener. Is this going to balance out the carbon dioxide, the levels that are in our atmosphere, such that these other green things are going to produce an increase in oxygen, therefore leveling the oxygen carbon dioxide mix?
Yeah, it will mitigate it, but only to a small fraction. It's not going to take care of all the excess carbon dioxide you're putting into the atmosphere, but it is true you get a greening effect. There's some concerns about that because we're getting a greening effect in the oceans, and now we're getting toxic algae blooms that weren't there before because they got enough carbon dioxide to really multiply. So, we're do seeing a benefit on the continents. The forests are lusher, and you do get more growth. I mean, that's one reason why if you want your plants to grow, sing to your plants, but sing really close so they can get the carbon dioxide from your breath. It'll actually make them grow a little better. So, people say, hey, if I talk to my plants, they do better. That's because of the carbon dioxide coming out of your mouth. So the closer you get to the plants, the better the effect. So, all right. That's another big news story that came out was this methane puff that they found on Mars. And there's speculation maybe it's a sign of life. There's many reasons why it won't. And if you want to read the details, the blog I posted a year and a half ago at reasons.org explains why it's got to be abiotic. But there's actually some debate about whether or not that effect is actually a real effect, because there are some inconsistencies with the different satellites trying to sniff out methane on Mars. But back to this paper published in the Astrophysical Journal, it's basically establishing limits to how much carbon dioxide can be in the atmosphere. We need a minimum amount for photosynthesis, but if you have too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you'll get circulatory arrest and acidosis at a level of 0.0051 over a 12-hour period. Now, that's important. We're not talking long-term exposure to carbon dioxide. If you're exposed to that level of carbon dioxide for just a 12-hour period, you're going to have serious health consequences. And these are just two. There's actually several in the list of consequences. And yes, emergency rooms are actually dealing with people that have carbon dioxide poisoning because they literally have been exposed to too much carbon dioxide and they immediately got to take care of that level. Matter of fact, I think 3 winters ago, we had 3 skiers die in the Mammoth area because it was winter time and they could not see the fumaroles that were emitting carbon dioxide. And so as they skied over it, they wound up consuming too much carbon dioxide and they literally died. So if you ever go to Mammoth, there's a place near Horseshoe Lake that's all cordoned off. Don't go there. Because carbon dioxide, you can't, there's no odor, but that's a place where carbon dioxide is coming out of the ground. And having been to Mammoth, I can tell you that's not the only fumarole. They're all over the place in the Mammoth area. And so if you see a patch where nothing's growing, don't walk across that patch. Or if you walk across that patch, walk across it quickly. You don't want to be there for more than a few seconds. And yeah, all over Mammoth, you've got spots that are 50 feet across, 100 feet across, where nothing grows. And so too much carbon dioxide not only kills animals, it kills plants. There was a question here. Can you wait for the microphone?
Basically, just a brief comment on the slide there, and that although you've mentioned it a couple times, the top one is a lower limit, and the bottom two are upper limits.
That's correct.
And the... you know, unless you look at that carefully, I mean, I think that should be pointed out. I mean, just to look at the slide, it's a little bit confusing unless you really understand that.
Yes. Okay. The upper one is a lower limit. The two bottom ones are upper limits. And the middle one is an upper limit for life in the oceans. The bottom one is a limit for short-term exposure to carbon dioxide. We don't know what the human limit is for long-term upper exposure to carbon dioxide because people have not been able to do the experiments. I mean, we could ask for a volunteer from the class to be exposed to a high dose of carbon dioxide for 10 years, and we can watch what happens to your health. That experiment's not been done for obvious ethical reasons. And we don't have any medical evidence where people have had long-term exposure to high carbon dioxide levels. But we have lots of evidence of what happens when people are exposed to high levels, much higher levels of carbon dioxide for a period of 6 hours, 8 hours, or 12 hours. And that's that limit there of 0.0051. But the whole point is, if you look at the history of the Earth, if you go back 3 billion years, we're talking about 8,000 to 10,000 parts per million carbon dioxide. That explains why for most of life's history on Earth, all you have are microbes, because microbes can handle much higher levels of carbon dioxide. But not until the carbon dioxide level drops below 790 parts per million do you actually have animals. So it explains why animals are relatively recent upon the face of the Earth. What I thought was most interesting about this paper is it's the first paper I've seen published establishing carbon monoxide levels. And I think most of you are aware that carbon monoxide is toxic, and you can't smell it or see it, but it's toxic because the hemoglobin in your blood will absorb carbon monoxide 234 times more efficiently than oxygen. And so that's how you die, is that your circulatory system, if there's lots of carbon monoxide there, will substitute that for the oxygen, and your body doesn't have enough oxygen to live. And some studies have been done on this, that if you're exposed to 9 parts per million carbon monoxide for 8 hours, that leads to serious health impairment. And what do they mean by serious health impairment? You could have a heart attack. You could be vomiting. You got an excruciating headache that just totally immobilizes you. What they basically mean by serious health impairment, you can't do anything in the way of useful work because of the experiences you're having. Now, they have been able to establish that if you're exposed to 1 part per million carbon monoxide continuously for a decade, you're going to get the same serious health consequences. Now, that's a limit that may be much lower than that. They simply know that people, and when they say continuously exposed, they really don't have the evidence. This mainly comes from medical records in Britain, where they've had people living in homes where there's continual carbon monoxide being released in the home just because of the outdated heating system, electrical system they have there. But it's always people that come and go from the home. And so we really don't know what the limit is for continuous exposure, because the only evidence we have is people living in a home where there's a low level of carbon monoxide, but they come and go from that to home. But they do know if it's at 1 part per million being emitted within that home, you're going to have serious health consequences. Now, where we get a lower limit here is that if we're talking circulatory plant and animal life, those life forms, and also microbes, they emit carbon monoxide. So there's a minimum level of carbon monoxide in any ecosystem that's got advanced life in it. The plants emit it, the microbes emit it, life emits it, animals emit it at a very low level. It's below 1 part per million, but they do emit it, so it gives us a lower limit. You got advanced life, you're going to have this much carbon monoxide on there, but a limit beyond, say, 1 part per million will be a problem. Okay, what this research paper did, they didn't take 1 part per million, they took 10 parts per million, and they said, what kind of planets are guaranteed to bring about 10 parts per million? And what they discovered is, because Earth is water-rich, and because it's orbiting a G-type star, the water in our atmosphere, the water vapor, basically knocks out carbon monoxide, at least to some degree. And so their point was, okay, for stars that are fainter than the sun, that mechanism will not work as efficiently, which means those atmospheres of planets orbiting M-type stars and K-type stars, stars that are smaller than the sun, are going to have more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And the other thing they discovered is if you've got a star like our sun, you're still going to have a carbon monoxide problem if the planet orbiting that star is significantly drier than the Earth, because it takes a lot of water vapor in the atmosphere to basically mitigate the production of carbon monoxide in the atmosphere. Bottom line, we don't have many habitable planets left, because if you add up all the M-type and K-type stars, that's 88% of all the stars. So they're immediately off the list. And that also pertains to this discovery or announcement that they found two habitable planets orbiting this M-type star 12 light years away, Tea Garden star, because it's going to have too much carbon monoxide on it, and it's going to have too much carbon dioxide, and so it's a non-candidate. Now, we know stars bigger than the sun, like the O, the B, the A, and the F-type stars, they're not going to be habitable because they burn up too quickly. Stars bigger than the sun will burn their nuclear fuel at a much more rapid rate, and also they get brighter and brighter at a much more rapid rate than the sun does. At such a rapid rate that you might have a possibility for short-lived microbial life, but you're not going to have advanced life. Advanced life requires a stable life situation for at least a couple of billion years, and stars bigger than the sun will be ruled out on that basis. But the paper also said we can expect that most G-type stars or planets orbiting G-type stars like our sun are going to be ruled out. And G-type stars make up 7% of all the stars in the universe. But it says the only way they're going to have a possibility to have low enough levels of carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide is if they have as much or more surface water than the Earth does. So they have less surface water, and if there's less water in the atmosphere, then they're not going to be what they call complex life habitable. In this paper, they define complex life as any life that's got a circulatory system. And so, bottom line, all M-type stars will have too much carbon monoxide. K-type stars with less surface water than the Earth will also have too much carbon monoxide. And if we're talking life forms like us, it eliminates all K-type stars. And G-type stars drier than the Earth will also have too much carbon monoxide. And if you go back about 2 months of the blogs, I write a blog every week, but about 2 months ago, I wrote one on what's called tiny habitable zones. And so that's where I talked about the 11 habitable zones that all have to be met for a planet to be truly habitable. And now we got the carbon monoxide habitable zone and the carbon dioxide habitable zone. But these are the 11 that I wrote about in that blog article about 2 to 2.5 months ago. And it kind of emphasizes what this paper in the Astrophysical Journal is pointing out, is it's time for us to revise the habitable zones and recognize they're extremely narrow. They're not as wide as what has been reported in the scientific literature. And where this got started, I mean, if you go to the NASA website, they will talk about how there may be 40 billion habitable planets in our Milky Way galaxy alone. But it's on the assumption that the liquid water habitable zone is the only habitable zone you got to worry about. They ignored the other 10, now 12 habitable zones. Moreover, they focus on the widest liquid water habitable zone. And so this is what you see here. you've got a very wide habitable zone. If you're talking about planets that had conceivable liquid water on their surface for a short period of time. So we're talking like 90 days or less. And what they're pointing out there, if you pump a whole lot of methane and carbon dioxide in a planet that's orbiting far away from its host star, those greenhouse gases will trap so much heat that it brings the temperature of the surface of that planet up to the temperature where liquid water could conceivably exist on the surface. But if you want water to hang around for, say, a million years, you get a much narrower habitable zone. And if you want water to hang around for a billion years, you get a very narrow habitable zone. And that's basically what this other paper is pointing out, that with carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide, you get the same treatment. The habitable zones become orders of magnitude narrower. And to illustrate this, this is the liquid water habitable zone that NASA talks about on their website. And as you can see, it's very broad. So you're going to have a high probability of planets of being within that habitable zone. Because if they got no atmosphere at all, that means it's going to trap no heat from its star, so you can make it much closer to the star. And if it's got very heavy greenhouse gas atmosphere, you can put it far away. But if you're talking about the planet actually having liquid water for a million years or more, now we've got a habitable zone that becomes much narrower. And if you want the habitable zone such that you've got the possibility for something other than a microbe, this is how big the habitable zone is. And actually, that's an exaggeration. If you really want to see how narrow the habitable zone is, this is how narrow it is. That's why I put this one up here, so you could actually see the ring, but this is what it really looks like, where you can barely see an outline. That's the habitable zone. Now, that's just one of the 13 habitable zones. The truth is, these habitable zones must overlap. And I think I mentioned this about a year ago here in the class, where they discovered the ultraviolet habitable zone. And what they notice is that different kinds of stars emit different amounts of ultraviolet radiation, and they emit them at different wavelengths. And we need long wavelength ultraviolet radiation for the synthesis of certain critical biochemicals to operate. So, for example, if you want enough vitamin D flowing in your body and you're not taking vitamin supplements, you're going to want to go outside once in a while so that your skin can be exposed to long radiation, ultraviolet radiation, because that's what's going to facilitate the synthesis of vitamin D. And that's just one example out of many biochemicals. And incidentally, it's not just animals. Plants need a minimum amount of this long wavelength ultraviolet radiation. But I think you're all aware, too much of a good thing is a problem. If you spend too much time outside, you get a sunburn. And if we're talking the short wavelength ultraviolet radiation, it will kill you. And so you need just the right amount of ultraviolet radiation at just the right wavelengths. And what they discovered is that stars that are less massive, and by the way, these are exaggerated. These zones are actually much narrower than what I put there, but I put it up here so you can actually see it, for stars that are less massive than the sun, the ultraviolet habitable zone is inside the liquid water habitable zone. And therefore, that's not a habitable planet. It's only habitable if they both overlap one another. And for stars more massive than the sun, you get the opposite, where the ultraviolet habitable zone is outside the liquid water habitable zone. So you're basically eliminating planets orbiting all stars where the mass is different than the mass of the sun. And the planet's got to be orbiting about the same distance from that host star as Earth does. And you say, well, how many Earth-sized planets have we found orbiting solar-type stars at the appropriate distance? Just one. Planet Earth is the only one of all the planets we discovered where we see the ultraviolet habitable zone overlapping the liquid water habitable zone. Now, it's possible we'll find stars and planets where they do overlap. On the other hand, they also have to overlap 11 other habitable zones, if they don't simultaneously overlap all 13 habitable zones, then the planet is not habitable. It's certainly not habitable for animal and plant life. Perhaps bacteria for a short period of time, but not animal and plant life. So, come Thanksgiving, you might want to thank God that we orbit a star like the sun and that we're orbiting at the right distance. But I would submit to you, this is really strong evidence that, that we're no accident in the universe, that our sun, our planetary system, our planet, our moon, our galaxy, are all designed by a super intelligent, supernatural creator because he wanted to create a home where we could live, and not only a home where we could live, but a home where we could thrive and launch global civilization. And it's something I've been sharing with my secular peers, science professors and science researchers that are not yet believers, is that when you look at the universe and our galaxy and our solar system, our star and our sun, what we notice is it's not just fine-tuned to make our existence possible, it's fine-tuned to make our civilization possible, it's fine-tuned to enable billions of us to live on this planet at one time, and it's fine-tuned so that billions of us can hear the message of redemption that we see communicated through nature and through the pages of the Bible. And if you do your science research from that kind of redemptive perspective, that God created the universe, our galaxy, and our solar system so that billions of us could hear the redemptive message and respond to the redemptive message, I'm basically challenging my peers, if you do that, you'll be more successful in making scientific discoveries. You'll be able to put to the test, is it really true that everything in the universe, every component of the universe, Earth, and Earth's life, and every event in the universe, Earth, and Earth's life, plays a role in making possible our redemption? It's a great way to advance the scientific enterprise. It's a great way to put the Christian message to a stronger and stronger scientific test. And I'm also hoping in the process that as people realize they're getting greater success in their scientific research, they say, maybe I'll see what this book, the Bible, has to say about how I should live my life. And moreover, the book of nature itself communicates that same message. It's a two-book set doctrine. Incidentally, I want to thank this church for having this day they had yesterday. They had a special day all day yesterday designed for what they call children interested in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. I had a role to play in that yesterday. I thought what was most fun, they got a bunch of JPL engineers to come out here with one of these little models of a Mars rover, and they had all the children lie down in random form on the carpet, and this thing would just go over them. Basically making the point, they had designed these rovers to be able to handle any kind of terrain. So it didn't matter how the kids oriented themselves on the carpet, this rover was able to just go right over the top of them. So, and you can imagine they really enjoyed that. So I did a little demonstration on our solar system that got them interested as well. But I'm just encouraged that this is a church that's communicating to children how the book of nature and the book of scripture go together. God's given us two books, the book of nature and the book of scripture. Okay, if there are no more questions, what I want to do is jump into our questions on Isaiah. Now, I think we've virtually wrapped up our question about how there's this resurgence of interest, and maybe the Earth is not spherical, but it's flat, and as physicists and astronomers have been lying to us, and NASA's been lying to us, there's this grand conspiracy. And last week we talked about first the biblical evidence, because that's what's really interesting, is that the flat Earth crowd, and by the way, this is a resurgence of flat Earth theology. It wasn't around 3 years ago, but it's around now, and it's growing at a fairly rapid rate. And we talked about how all the biblical texts they quote to claim that the Bible is a flat Earth book are simply passages by inference. There is no direct passage in the Bible declaring that the Earth is flat. Matter of fact, there's stronger biblical evidence for a spherical earth than there is for a flat earth. And so they'll say things, well, the Bible talks about the ends of the earth. While we actually look at the word earth, it's referring to the land masses of the earth. The ends of the earth are the coastlines of the continents and the oceans. So it's not talking about the edge of a disk. Where it talks about the four corners of the earth. Well, I know physicists and astronomers that talk about the four corners of the earth, and they mean it as a figure of speech. I think people were using that as a figure of speech literally for thousands of years. Now, it's interesting, if you actually look at the Hebrew word for corner, it can also be the word quarter. And if you're talking like the four quarters of the orange, suddenly the figure of the speech is actually talking about something spherical. However, those who are pushing the idea that the Bible is a flat earth book, their primary text is Isaiah 40:22. Isaiah 40:22, where it says, God looks down on the circle of the earth. And so if he's looking down on a circle, that means the earth is a flat disk. But what they're overlooking is, if God is above looking down on the earth, only a sphere would appear as a circle from all different perspective angles. And incidentally, in the Hebrew language, they don't have biblical Hebrew. They don't have a word for sphere. They use this word tube, which is actually translated circle. But because there is no word for sphere, you would use that same word tube to actually refer to a sphere. So it could be God looking down on the orb of the earth. So the whole point is, Isaiah 40:22 in no way can be considered a proof text for a flat earth. And we quickly reviewed all the scientific evidence that the flat earth is simply an incorrect position. Let me see. Yeah, we went through all this. I'm going to just go through this very quickly. This, by the way, is the present model of the flat earth theory, that the edge of the disk is Antarctica, and that stops the water from flowing over the edge. There's an ice barrier that keeps all the water on the disk. Can we get a microphone over here, please? Got a question here.
I'm curious to know if any of the flat earth people have said how thick the disk is.
Yes, they actually commented how thick the disk is. They altered their model. The model they had 50 years ago was that we had this flat disk, but underneath it was a cone, and the cone was filled with water. Because the model they had at that time is that the earth was surrounded by these oceans and the water was spilling over the edge. And so it's like, well, what replaces the water that spills over the edge? And they got this enormous cone underneath the earth that's pumping water up. So as water spills over the edge, more water comes up to replenish the water that's there. That's the old model. The new model says we don't have to worry about that because we got Antarctica that creates an ice barrier that stops the water from spilling over the edge. And therefore, instead of having this giant cone underneath, it's just a flat disk. So think of it like a discus. Now, in terms of how thick it is, they would have it at least tens of miles thick. Because they're aware that, you know, we can drill down through the crust. So they have it at least as thick as far down as we've been able to drill. So, but I've not seen anything where they comment on whether it's thicker than, say, 100 miles deep. But they certainly do believe it's at least 20 miles deep. Okay, that's their model. And as we mentioned last week, I'm going to go through this quickly. One of the evidence that the Earth is not flat but is spherical is a crow's nest effect. That if you get high enough above the surface of the Earth, you can see more distantly away. And so this has been used by sailors for hundreds of years. They put a sailor up in the crow's nest because that sailor in the crow's nest can see much farther away than a sailor that's on the deck of the ship. If the Earth was flat, it wouldn't make any difference. So this makes an example. If you're on the deck, you're not going to be able to see the mast of that distant ship. And here's actually a photograph of a distant ship, and you notice you can't see the bottom part of the ship. In the same way that residents of Seattle cannot see the bottom part of Mount Rainier. They just see the top part of Mount Rainier. And I think I mentioned too, when I did go up Mount Baker, which is just south of the Canadian border, and you know, a couple hundred miles away from Mount Rainier, we could just see the tippy top of Mount Rainier from that great distance. We were not able to see the bottom part. And that's evidence that's because of the sparsity of the Earth, the bottom part is blocked out. And I showed this video clip last week, which actually historically is the first clue that ancients had that the Earth was spherical, because they would look at an eclipse of the moon where they realized that the shadow on the moon was a shadow from the Earth, and what they noticed was its shadow always had a curved edge to it. And no matter when they observed or where they observed the lunar eclipse, they always saw that same curved edge, and therefore they said the Earth has to be a sphere, because only a sphere would give you that kind of a curve from all different viewing angles. And they also looked at the curvature of that curve to get a rough estimate of the diameter of the Earth. But 2,500 years ago, the ancients actually measured the diameter of the Earth because they were able to use geometry to figure out that the Sun was about 82 million miles away from the Earth. That was their measurement. We actually know they're a little bit off. It's 92.956 million miles, so they're off by about 12%. But that's still quite close, and that means it was distant enough that they could assume that sunlight coming towards the Earth is basically parallel at all locations on the Earth. And they simply went to deep wells at different parts in Egypt and noticed at the summer solstice, June 21st, that they got a different angle of sunlight going down in Alexandria deep wells than they did in Syene. And by noting the angular difference, they were able to determine the circumference of the Earth. Not only showed that the Earth was spherical, but they were actually able to measure the circumference of the Earth. And they measured it to be 25,200 miles in circumference. The real number is 24,901, which means they measured it to slightly better than a percent of precision. Quite remarkable that they were able to measure it that accurately. So, and then we got the Great Circle. You know, what really amazes me is that these flat Earth people not only think that we physicists and astronomers are part of a grand conspiracy, they think the airlines are in on it too. Because when you travel on an airplane, you don't go the shortest distance that you would see on a flat projection of the continents. You take a curve. So this is an example of flying from Los Angeles, or Chicago, pardon me, to Dubai. And instead of taking a straight line path, you take a curved path. And here's an example where you go from Los Angeles to Halifax. And so here's a flat projection map. But when you get on an airplane, you don't take that shortest distance according to the flat map. You take a curve. And these flat Earth people are saying, well, the airlines are doing that on purpose to deceive us into thinking that we're flying across a spherical Earth. I think they're more concerned about the fuel costs than they are, because if the Earth is a sphere, the shortest distance is actually that curve, not that supposed straight line. And I think you would go out of business pretty quickly if you didn't fly the shortest route possible. But that's the story that the airlines are in on the conspiracy. And the other thing I wanted to share with you is that all flat Earth people are they're basically telling us the stars are not as far away as the astronomers tell us they are. Neither is the sun. The sun and the planets are all much closer than what the astronomers tell us. We're on this flat Earth, and the stuff is going around us, and it's not very far away. Well, it tells me that they've forgotten their high school geometry theorems. And I talked to you about this theorem last week, that if you know the base of the triangle and the angles at each end of that base of the isosceles triangle, that gives you the length of the two sides and the distance to the vertex, and how astronomers use this routinely to determine the distances not only to the sun, the moon, and the planets, but also to the stars. Now, what the ancients were doing is they used the base of the triangle over two very distant cities. But they quickly figured out that with the Earth orbiting about the sun, and by the way, the ancients knew that it wasn't geocentric. They knew it was heliocentric. And incidentally, geocentrism has never gone away. This idea that the Bible teaches that the Earth is the center of the universe and the center of the solar system. There have been people believing that for the last couple of thousand years, but they're also in the same camp of saying these stars are not far away. They're close by. Likewise, the sun is not far away. It's close by. And likewise, the planets. But again, just use this simple high school geometry that you were taught, and you can determine that that is false, that the stars are very far away, and we can actually, the ancients were actually able to measure the distance of the sun to relatively, well, to within 10% precision. And this shows you how they actually measure distances to stars, where they use the orbit of the Earth above the sun, which gives them a baseline of 186 million miles, and they measure the angle towards that star relative to the much more distant galaxies and stars, say, at the summer solstice, and compare it with the winter solstice, and then they're able to determine the distance to that star to high precision. And I put this up here at the beginning of the class because this is another piece of evidence that the Earth must be spherical. You're not going to get the tides that we observe if the Earth is flat. Only with a spherical Earth are you going to get the tides that we observe. Moreover, our tides are complex. We get a tide from the sun, and we get a tide from the moon. And you can actually measure that throughout the orbit of the moon about the Earth, is that when the moon and the sun line up, you get an especially big tide, and when they're off by a perpendicular, you get an especially low tide. And we can see that month to month and day to day. We also notice that the tides are delayed because water takes time to react to the tidal forces. You actually have a delay, and again, none of this works unless the Earth is a sphere. So we simply need to educate people about the math and the physics that they learned in school. Although I did a survey here with a lot of you, I was taught this stuff when I was in grade 2, grade 3, grade 4. I hear in California, you really don't get it until you're grade 10, grade 11. And often it's in a class that's optional, so you don't get it at all. And I think that's helping you understand why this story of a flat Earth has gotten such a grip. Last survey indicated that 8% of the U.S. adult population believes that the Earth is flat. To me, that's phenomenal. To me, it's a testimony of how we're failing to educate our students here in mathematics and physics. And I relish the day, this is what was happening in the Victorian era of England, where if you went on to university, physics was not an option, it was required. And maybe a little bit of that needs to be brought back in, so people have at least a little basic understanding. And again, what I found out talking to my wife and a number of you, you weren't taught geometry the way I was taught geometry. My wife says she was simply told to memorize the solutions to the theorems. The way I was taught in Canada, we were told, we don't want you to memorize them. We want you to prove them from first principles just like the Greeks did. Because if you do that, you remember it. And you actually can see the derivation from that first principle. Okay, we've got a little bit of time left to jump into our study question on Isaiah. And I'm actually old enough now that I need this occasionally to read this stuff because the lights here aren't strong enough. I didn't have to use these when I was in 154, but until we get new lights here, I'm going to have to put my glasses on once in a while. Okay. We looked at the question about what does Isaiah say about the shape of the earth? Another big controversy, and this is actually been a debate I've been involved in now for 30 years, is what does the Bible say about the end of the earth, the end of the universe, and the new age? And if you've looked at the book of Isaiah, it says a lot about what's going to happen in the future to the earth and the universe and the stars and where we're going to spend all of eternity. Now, I'm not going to have time to get into this, but I've got enough time to actually assign you some studies, okay? The controversy is this. Is there people reading the Bible and they say, well, look at these passages in the New Testament, and there are three of them, that talk about how God's going to restore everything. So they're basically using those texts to say that what's going to happen after sin and evil are eliminated is we're going to have Jesus come back, he's going to fix everything up here on earth, it's all going to be restored, and we get to spend eternity here on earth. Contrasted with people look at the Bible and say, well, wait a minute, look at these texts that talk about the stars disappearing, how God's going to end the universe's existence, and how the new creation is going to be in some place where the physics is different and the dimensions are different. Now, this was a relatively minor debate 30 years ago. It's become a really big debate today. And I'm experiencing that when I speak on seminary campuses, how there's all these seminary professors, conservative and liberal, who are thinking this earth is our eternal home. And books have come out recently by a number of people that are much better selling authors than I am, telling people this is going to be our eternal home. Now, I want to equip all of you in how to deal with this debate from the book of Isaiah. Isaiah is not silent on this subject. I think the reason why this debate has such fervency, there's a couple of reasons. They're focusing on the New Testament and ignoring what the Old Testament's got to say. And they're also, I would say, looking at the book of Revelation from a figurative perspective rather than a literal perspective. And so what I want us to do, and you're going to notice when you look at the book of Revelation, how much it reflects certain chapters in the book of Isaiah. So we're going to take those two books and try to integrate them. Here's the New Testament text, which is basically saying things are going to be radically different. Isaiah's saying the same thing, but how can we marshal these texts in Revelation, Isaiah, to bring resolution to this debate? Now, just for a very practical theological reason, I personally have a problem with Earth being our eternal home. Of course, as an astronomer, I got a lot of other reasons for why I don't think Earth is going to be that pleasant of a home in the future if God retains the physics that he does. But I think another factor is driving this. In fact, a couple of books have come out from theologians saying, you know, this planet that God has given us is so beautiful and so wonderful, a 90-year lifetime does not do it justice. And therefore, when the Lord returns, he's going to give us enough time, namely all eternity, to take care of our bucket list. Because, I mean, if you've got the financial means, it's really easy to develop a bucket list. I want to see all these different places on the earth. I want to do all these things. I want to climb Mount Everest. I want to go down into the deepest trench and the Marianas Trench. I want to see all the world's most beautiful waterfalls. And I want to go to all the national parks in the world. And yeah, 90 years is not enough time to do justice to that. You've got to pick and choose. On the other hand, if we're spending eternity here on earth, I think you could exhaust your bucket list quite quickly. I mean, 30,000 years probably ought to do it, right? Before you're able to tick off everything. Of course, the people who are writing these books are saying, well, after you've done all these things, you're going to want to do them again. Just like people want to go to a certain favorite vacation spot over and over again. And we really do need eternity to see them all. Okay, another theological critique I would like to suggest is, if you're claiming that Earth is our eternal home, how many humans can live here at one time and really enjoy visiting all these bucket lists? I mean, I do like what Yogi Berra said about one beautiful vacation place. He says, it's so crowded that nobody goes there anymore. Typical Yogi Berraism. That's the point. is that there's some beautiful places, but there's so many people going there, it's no longer a pleasant experience. I'll give you one example that's close to home. You know, going up Half Dome has got to be on everybody's bucket list. However, it's such now that if you go up Half Dome, it's single file when you're up on the dome itself. You don't get to see much. You get to see the person in front of you, and you got somebody right behind you bumping you along. It's that crowded. So, frankly, I don't want to go up Half Dome. That's just not a pleasant experience. I'd rather go someplace where I got the entire park to myself. In fact, we were talking earlier about how in August, Kathy and I are going to go to a place in British Columbia where they helicopter you in. It's a gorgeous place. There's no trails, and there's no people. There's more bears and goats than there are human beings there. And it's a place where we know, okay, for an entire week, we might see 12 human beings maximum. In fact, there was one trip I took 3 years ago where for an entire day, I was in a place where no human being had even visited over the past decade. Now, it's a different kind of experience when you're in a place like that. But if you're in there with 10 million other people, it has a different feel. As any of you know have gone into Yosemite Valley in the summertime, okay? It's just jammed with people. Okay, which raises an interesting theological point. How many people do you think Jesus Christ will redeem from their sin and evil? I would agree with that. I don't think it's just going to be 144,000. I think it's going to be a much bigger number than that. And Jesus did say, narrow is the door that leads to salvation. But he indicated that there would be people going through that narrow door. And so it is clear from a number of different passages, the majority of human beings do not want to spend eternity with their God. They're in rebellion against God, and they want to spend eternity without him. God's got a place for those people, where God's never going to visit them and they won't be bothered by God. And I basically tell people, God gives you a choice where to spend eternity. You can spend eternity in continual fellowship with God, or if you don't like God, you can spend eternity where you don't have to worry about him bothering you for the rest of eternity. However, it tells us in Zechariah 13 that with respect to the Jews, God's chosen people, a day will come when one-third of them will recognize the one that they have pierced and become followers, become disciples of Jesus Christ. That establishes a large fraction, a third. We're not talking 0.0003%, we're talking 33%. And we also have a number of passages where it talks about God wanting to reach the Gentiles in the same way that he reaches the Jews. So, at least from my theological perspective, the redemptive offer will be received by a minority of human beings, but it'll be a large minority, not a small minority. And I think evidence for that is Jesus Christ has not come back. He said he would return when we've taken the good news of salvation to all the ethnic groups of the world where we make a significant number of disciples and all those different ethnic groups. Well, he hasn't come back yet. And the statistics today tell us that at least 10% of the current human population are not only self-declared Christians, they're involved in bringing other people to faith in Christ through their personal evangelism and through their financial support to people who are focused on bringing the gospel message to all the people groups of the world. So the fact that it's running between 8 to 9% minimum of the total human population tells us that we're looking at a minimum of 8 to 9% of all humans who've ever lived being part of the redeemed host. Okay, which raises a question. How many human beings have lived since Adam and Eve were created by God? A low figure is 110 billion. A high figure is 135 billion. Okay. 8 to 9% of, say, 120 billion people adds up to how many people? Anybody quickly do the math here? 11 or 12 billion people. Okay, that raises a question. And incidentally, if we're talking more like 20% or 25% or 30% of the human population, now we're talking 30 to 40, 45 billion people that will be part of the redeemed host. Can our planet support that many human beings given its present condition for a long period of time? There are papers published saying the population we have today is not sustainable. It's sustainable for a short period, but it's not sustainable for tens of thousands of years. There's too many of us consuming the resources of this relatively tiny planet. And so the message in the Bible is our eternal home will sustain us comfortably for all eternity. And our planet simply isn't big enough to be able to sustain 30, 40 billion. It can't even sustain 11 or 12 billion. And there have been papers published saying, okay, how many people can planet Earth sustain permanently without any change in the present conditions of the Earth, realizing that the Earth today in its history is optimal for sustaining human beings? And the answer is 1 billion.
1 billion.
We could sustain 1 billion at a high standard of living and a high standard of health, literally permanently, assuming the sun weren't to get any brighter. Of course, the sun is getting brighter. That's going to be a problem. But that way, we could recycle the resources we need and keep a billion people going. Right now, we're at 7.5 billion. So at 7.5 billion, it means we're running through the resources at a faster rate than we can recycle them. So now, I personally am not bothered by that. If the Lord returns quickly, having 7 or 8 billion people on the planet right now is not a problem. It's only a problem if Jesus doesn't return for another 50,000 years. If he doesn't return for another 50,000 years, yes, we're going to have a huge problem trying to sustain 8 billion humans at a high standard of living. So, and in that sense, having billions of people here in the face of the earth with our high civilization, high technology, actually enables us to fulfill the Great Commission quickly. So I think it was God's intent all along that our population would get to this level so that the gospel message could be rapidly communicated. Because not only do we have a high population, we got the highest technology we've ever had in the history of humanity. And it's because of that high technology we see people coming to faith in Jesus Christ at a number rate that's simply unprecedented. It's something I documented in Improbable Planet, that if you look at world history in terms of the number of people responding to the gospel message per decade, what we're seeing the last few decades is completely unprecedented. To give you an idea, the number of people at the beginning of the 20th century that were visibly committed to seeing other people come to faith in Christ was 2.7%. Right now, it's sitting at about 9%. So it's gone from, it's literally more than tripled in just the last 120 years. And it has never happened before in human history, or as advanced that fast. In fact, I got a table in the last chapter of Improbable Planet, which shows you the rate of the growth of the Christian community per century all the way through. And right now, it's at a very high accelerating rate, which tells me that if we can simply motivate more of God's people to be committed to fulfill the Great Commission, we could see the return of the Lord. And here I'm quoting from a previous class member. He's passed away, but there was a Fuller Seminary missions professor who used to attend this class semi-regularly, Ralph Winter. And when he was alive, he wrote a number of theology research papers making this point that the Christian community today has enough people, enough money, and enough technology to fulfill the Great Commission in 5 years. All we lack is the motivation. Moreover, he wrote in those papers, if we could simply get the Christian community as a whole investing 1% of their income in fulfilling the Great Commission, we could fulfill the Great Commission in under one decade. But here's the problem. The vast majority of Christians don't give anything. And those that do tend to give 4 to 5 to 8% of their income. And you know, Ralph was saying, well, all you need to do is get everybody to donate 10 times as much as they are now, because the average for the whole Christian community is 0.1%. So he said, we just increase that by a factor of 10. Here's the problem with that. There's no way you're going to get some people who are giving 5% of their income to give 50%. That's not going to work. We've got to get the people that are giving 0 to give 0.5% or 1%. Give something. And so that's been the message of Reasons to Believe. We all need to do at least something. If we do something, that means the Lord will return relatively quickly, and you won't have to be worried about politics anymore. Okay? Look how much of your time is wasted by engaging in political debates and political discussions. If we got Jesus Christ ruling in downtown Jerusalem, you're going to save a whole lot of time. You're going to be able to talk about the weather instead of politics, or your golf game instead of politics. And I don't know what's going to happen to golf courses when the Lord returns. That's another point of speculation. But that's the whole point. I think just based on the limited carrying capacity of the earth, we could argue that the eternal home is not here on planet earth. On the other hand, I'll tell you this. The books promoting that we're going to be spending eternity here on earth are way outselling the books that are saying our eternal home is going to be in a different dimensional realm. And it wasn't like that 100 years ago. It's like that today. So that's why I put this in the study questions of our study on Revelation. But what I want to do, notice we got a number of questions here that deal with the time of the end. Here's what I'd like to do in the remaining minutes we got here, which is to give you an assignment. What does Isaiah's prophecy say about the time of the end? That's question 6. Question 7, how does Isaiah exhort us to prepare for the time of the end? And number 9, what does Isaiah tell us about the millennium? And what does Isaiah, question 10, tell us about the new creation? And number 11, what does Isaiah say about God's evangelists? Okay, and maybe 12 is relevant too. Isaiah 55, God's thoughts and ways are not like our ways. And that should tell us right away that when he's talking about our eternal home, he's probably talking about it from his perspective, his thoughts and ways, and not our thoughts and ways. Okay, what I'd like to do next week is actually break you into groups, where each group will take on one of these questions. But what I want you to do between now and next week, matter of fact, it'd be good if I could break into groups right now, because then you could actually do some advanced study on these texts. And again, here's a challenge. Read through the entire book of Isaiah in one sitting. And one sitting, I mean, we're talking like 20 minutes or less. 20, 30 minutes, read through the whole book of Isaiah with your study question in mind. You'll get bogged down if you're trying to understand everything Isaiah's got to say. Just focus on your study question. You should be able to get through it quickly, pick up the passages, and be prepared to discuss it. So let's see. We got 1, 2, 3, well, we got 5 rows here. Okay, if you're in row number 1, you got question 6. Row number 2, it's got question 7. Row number 3 has got question 9. Row number 4 has got question 10. And the last row has got question 11. So between now and next week, take a look at the book of Isaiah. It's a pleasant exercise. And yes? Oh, we actually got a 6th row. Okay. Row 6, why does row 6 go in with row 5? I think that will work, because it looks like row 5 is the least populated. So we'll put all the row 6 people in with row 5. And here's what's going to happen. If you sit in the wrong row next week, well, be prepared to study work on someone else's question than the one you worked on. So kind of remember what role you're in and come back to that same role. But please, between now and next week, get through the book of Isaiah and just look at Isaiah in the context of your question. And by the way, I think it's just like our study on the Trinity doctrines. You're going to be amazed at what you discover. It's just incredible the detail we see here in the book of Isaiah on these study questions. And hopefully, it's going to equip you to deal with these debates that are going on about our future home. And by the way, this isn't just an exercise on dealing with debates. It tells us in 1 Corinthians 2 that we are to, no one can think or imagine how great and wonderful our eternal home will be. But that same Apostle Paul said, every day, spend some time meditating how great and wonderful it'll be. Whatever you come up with, it'll be better than that. And that's what I want to leave you with as you go through Isaiah. Whatever you come up with, it's going to be better than what you discovered in the book of Isaiah. With that, I'm going to bow for prayer, and then we'll see you all next week. Father in heaven, I want to thank you for this amazing man that you raised up, Isaiah. Lord, the suffering he went through to communicate your message is just unbelievable. But Father, you gave him the perseverance, the strength, and the health to be able to provide us with this incredible book over a 60-year span of his life. So thank you for using that man in such an amazing way. And Father, I pray that as we study this book, it will prepare us for our future home. And thank you, Lord, that we are just passing through. As beautiful as this planet is, you've got something far better in mind for us. But Father, I pray too that you'd equip us in such a way that we can get Christians and non-Christians alike excited about the future. There's so much depression today about what lies around the corner for our civilization and our planet. Father, I pray that you would grant us optimism based on what we see in this book of Isaiah. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.
We passed them out.
Everybody in my